Bringing you the latest case law updates on the legal aspects of law enforcement. This is Broadcast Blue.
Hello and welcome to Broadcast Blue. I'm your host, Bruce Allen Barnard, and I'm delighted to bring you this, our very first edition of the Broadcast Blue podcast. Over the next 60 minutes, we're going to take a look at several cases that came out within the last few weeks and that involve the legal aspects of law enforcement. Just to give you a heads up, I'll name the case, give you a summary of the major facts, discuss the law that applies to the issues presented by the case, and then let you know how the court decided it. The issues we discuss are constitutional issues that have broad applicability to law enforcement across the country. So all the cases are federal cases, most often from one of the United States Circuit Courts of Appeal. So now you know how it works. Let's take a look at the first case on this week's broadcast. The first case we're going to take a look at today is United States versus Cohn. Now this case comes to us from the 10th Circuit, and the decision was published on the 24th of August, just a few weeks ago. So let's take a look at the facts. In November of 2015, Tulsa police officer Peter Mayer was driving on patrol, and about 10:30 in the evening, he noticed a white pickup truck that had crossed through an intersection in front of him without a functioning license plate light. Now, that's a violation of Oklahoma law, which gives him the ability to pull this person over and issue a citation, but that's not what he did. And without activating his lights, he just turned around in order to go after the truck. He found the truck just a couple minutes later in a motel parking lot, and this parking lot itself was near another motel that was well known to him to be a place where criminal activity occurred. In fact, he and his partners had made several arrests for narcotics trafficking and firearms offenses in that immediate area. So Officer Mayer parks his vehicle. He approached the defendant's parked truck by foot, knocks on the driver's side window. And again, this has been this all takes place in about 2 minutes from when he first observed the traffic violation. The defendant lowered his window, and Mayer asked him for his identification information, asked him for his driver's license, and informed him that his car's tag light was not working properly. The defendant in this case acknowledged that he was the person who had been driving when he was seen by Officer Mayer earlier. Officer Mayer asked him if he'd ever been in trouble before, and he said yes. And then he asked him whether he'd been to prison before, and the defendant again replied yes. And then Mayer asked him for what, and the defendant falsely claimed that it was for money laundering. After Officer Mayer asked the defendant, John Cohn, these questions about his identification and his background, his criminal history, he then also asked him questions about what he was doing there in the hotel parking lot and who he was visiting. And they spoke about that, according to the record, very, very briefly. So at this point, Officer Mayer is planning to run his wants and warrants check, the warrant inquiry, and then check the status of Defendant Cohn's driver's license, and he followed what was his routine or typical practice of having the driver step out of the vehicles while he ran this computer check. So he does that in this case, and as the defendant, Cohn, gets out of his vehicle, Mayer then noticed that there was a butt of a pistol protruding from underneath the truck's center console, and at this point, Officer Mayer drew his pistol and told the defendant to get on the ground, and after a very brief exchange, the defendant attempted to flee, but then Mayer apprehended him. Now, another officer, Christy Score, arrives on the scene to back up Officer Mayer, and she secures the defendant's truck, and she finds the pistol that was spotted by Officer Mayer, and she found it to be loaded. She seizes this pistol, and she unloads it. But while she's inside the vehicle, she detects the odor of marijuana coming from the passenger side of the truck. And so she goes over and opens the passenger side door and finds a backpack containing drugs, including marijuana and methamphetamine, as well as small bags and digital scales. So Cohn was charged with being a felon in possession of a firearm and possessing methamphetamine, cocaine, oxycodone, and MDMA with the intent to distribute, as well as one count of possessing a firearm in relation to a drug trafficking crime. So Mr. Cohn's in a bucket load of trouble here, and you know what the defense attorney's going to do? He's going to use that defense F word. Hey, that's not fair. And he's going to argue that this is a violation of the Fourth Amendment, that some of the activity, some of the actions that were taken by the officers in this case were Fourth Amendment violations. Remember that domino theory of the Fourth Amendment, right? You've got to have all your dominoes lined up. All of your Fourth Amendment issues have to be proper. If you have one bad Fourth Amendment decision in a chain of Fourth Amendment decisions, it can give rise to the exclusionary rule. And so that's what the defense attorney is going to do here, right? He's going to argue that there were Fourth Amendment violations that took place, hoping that he can win on just one of them, because that's all that it's going to take. So the defense attorney has a two-prong attack here. First, he attacks Officer Mayer's credibility about the stop itself, saying that the initial stop was improper and invalid under the Fourth Amendment. And then he argued that the officer conducted an improper investigation by questioning the defendant, Cohn, about information and subjects that were totally irrelevant to the tag light offense for which the original stop took place. At the trial court level, the court denied these motions to suppress the evidence, and the defendant was sentenced to 151 months in prison. So that's where we're at. That's the posture of this case going up on appeal. We're going to have to look at the stop itself, and then the questions that were asked, the investigation that took place in asking these questions that wasn't related to the traffic stop, as the defense argues. First, it's important to note that the traffic stop has to be justified at its inception. And generally speaking, officers' actions during that stop must be reasonably related in scope to the mission of the stop itself. Now, we had a really important case, a really big case that came out of the United States Supreme Court back in 2015, and of course that case was Rodriguez versus United States. The site for that is 135 Supreme Court, 1609. A very important case, because in that particular case, the situation that we had was where the officer who was a canine unit had conducted a traffic stop, and he had done this traffic stop and was finished with the traffic stop and had handed all the information back to the defendant in that case, Rodriguez, had given him his license and registration and all the paperwork back. He'd already run his wants and warrants. And so he was finished with the traffic violation. In fact, he gave the guy a warning. And after he was finished and he hands all the paperwork back, he asked Rodriguez for permission to search the vehicle, and Rodriguez declined, said, "No, I'm not giving you consent to search the vehicle." And so the officer said, "Well, hang on there, wait a minute, don't go anywhere." And then he called for backup, because he couldn't walk his dog around the car without backup there to keep eyes on the defendant, a very safe thing to do. And so there were 7 or 8 minutes that went by before the backup arrived so the officer could walk his canine around Rodriguez's car. And then the dog alerted, and the car was searched. The sniff created probable cause, and the vehicle was a mobile conveyance. And so under the Carroll Doctrine, or the mobile conveyance doctrine, the warrantless search of the car took place. And drugs were found, because the dog was a good dog, a reliable dog, and they found exactly what they thought they would as a result of that sniff. And the Supreme Court and Justice Scalia said, "Well, wait a minute. As soon as this traffic stop was over, the initial traffic stop was a legitimate stop, and that's your first Fourth Amendment domino. And he pulls the car over for a traffic infraction, and that was legitimate. But at the point that he was totally finished with all of the paperwork, he'd run the wants and warrants, and he'd done all of his background checks, and he gives the stuff back to the driver, at that point, without a reasonable suspicion that this person's involved in criminal activity, such that you would have another type of seizure that could take place, the traffic stop seizure was over. There was no reason to extend the traffic stop any longer, and that was unreasonable. And remember, the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness. And so the Supreme Court said that there, with absent that reasonable suspicion that would have turned that traffic stop into a Terry stop, and without a gap, and lining those dominoes up upright, without that reasonable suspicion, there was no reason to keep them there. There was no justifiable extension or way to extend that seizure under the Fourth Amendment to have it be reasonable. And so that's the lesson of Rodriguez from a couple of years ago, and it's a very important one and something that we tend to forget, that we have to line everything up. These Fourth Amendment decisions aren't made in a vacuum. We typically have one Fourth Amendment decision take place that leads into another Fourth Amendment decision. You have the traffic stop that led to the dog sniff, that led to the search of the vehicle under the Carroll Doctrine, that led to the seizure of the drugs under the Plainview Seizure Doctrine, and that's in Rodriguez. You have to line these dominoes up in order to make these Fourth Amendment decisions. And at the end of the day, the very last domino is typically the evidence that's going to be used against the defendant. And so it's important to have those Fourth Amendment dominoes lined up. And so basically the argument that the defense attorney is making in this case with his client, Mr. Cohn, is that these dominoes did not line up. That there was a gap. Like Rodriguez, he was asking him questions that did not pertain to the traffic stop, and so it exceeded the scope of the stop, and therefore it became unreasonable when it exceeded the scope and the purpose of that temporary detention in order to investigate that traffic stop and issue a citation or a summons. So in this case, the traffic stop, like it was in Rodriguez, the traffic stop was justified at its inception because Officer Mayer observed an act that took place that was a citable offense under the traffic code, not having the light for the license plate on the back of the car. So next we get to the questions that were asked, and there were two sets of questions. There was a set of questions that dealt with identification and criminal history, and then there was a set of questions that dealt with the purpose of what his travel plans were and what his purpose was for being in the hotel. So let's take a look at each of those in turn and see what we think, applying this analysis and looking at whether or not this was an impermissible extension of the detention and exceeded the scope of the traffic stop. So the first thing we look at are these criminal history questions. And you recall Officer Mayer asked the defendant whether he'd ever been in trouble before, whether he'd been to prison before, and asked him what he had been convicted of. And so he asked all these questions. And the defendant argues that these questions had no direct relation to the broken taillight, and therefore it was it exceeded the scope and unnecessarily and unreasonably extended the seizure. But the court notes that an officer's mission during a traffic stop is not limited to determining whether to issue a ticket or not, right? And even in Rodriguez, the case itself, the Supreme Court declared that a mission includes ordinary inquiries that are incident to the traffic stop. And the court also recognized that traffic stops are especially fraught with danger to police officers. And the court has concluded that these types of inquiries are constitutionally permissible and recognizing an officer's need to make sure that he can complete his mission safely. The Tenth Circuit noted that running a computer check of a driver's criminal history is justifiable and is permissible under the Fourth Amendment as an inquiry useful for officer safety. And then they said, we fail to see how asking the driver about that history could be unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment. If running the computer check is reasonable, the information requested by Mayer did not exceed the scope of what the computer check would have revealed. The court noted that a driver's answer might not be as reliable as a computer check, but the time involved is actually shorter. So just allowing the officer to ask the question could provide important clues pertaining to the safety, such as nervous or evasive responses. So when it comes to the questions about the person's criminal history is concerned in this case, the court said, if asking for a person's identity is justified because it may help discover a record of violence, surely there is nothing wrong with the more directly relevant and efficient inquiry concerning criminal history. We conclude that the criminal history questions were not unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment. But what about the travel plan questions? Remember, Officer Mayer asked the defendant something along the lines of, what are you doing here? Who are you visiting here? And the purpose for him being in that high crime motel parking lot area. And the court even noted that the defendant properly pointed out that inquiring into the defendant's reason for being at the hotel was not related to the broken taillight because the defendant had already reached his destination and had parked the truck. So the Tenth Circuit, it seems, is leaning towards the decision that this was actually not permissible and that it was a Fourth Amendment violation. The questions about the travel plans might have been a Fourth Amendment violation. But then they punt. They didn't answer that question because they assume, for the sake of argument, assume that it's a Fourth Amendment violation. And they said, even assuming that it is a Fourth Amendment violation, in order for the exclusionary rule to kick in and the evidence to be suppressed, the evidence seized by the officers, the defendant has to establish a causal link between the alleged Fourth Amendment violation and the discovery of the evidence that's being contested. In this case, it would be the drugs. So they call this the but-for test, and it's very similar when lawyers study negligence in law school, the whole concept of causation in fact and proximate cause. Cause in fact is sometimes called the but-for test, and this is very similar to that. In other words, but for the fact that this Fourth Amendment violation occurred, the evidence would not have been found, and therefore it must be suppressed. And the burden is on the defendant to show that this is the case, that this is the situation. But the court noted in this particular case, the defendant failed to show this but for, this factual nexus between the travel plan questioning and the discovery of the drugs. The court very specifically noted the chain of events so that took place after Mayer's questioning of the defendant. So Mayer asked the defendant who he is. He asked him about his criminal history. He's asked him to step out of his vehicle while he runs the background check. And upon stepping out of the vehicle, that's when he first saw the pistol there in plain sight. Now, he sees this firearm in plain sight after this guy tells him he's been convicted of a felony and he's been to jail. So at that point in time, he's got the ability to arrest this person and to seize that firearm, right? Because that's a plain view seizure, lawful observation, lawful access, immediately recognizable as evidence or contraband, which is the rule for that plain view seizure, a judicially recognized exception. And at that point, they're able to get into the car in order to get that gun under the Carroll Doctrine, the mobile conveyance and plain view seizure, judicially recognized exception. It was the act of securing this weapon, of possessing this firearm, of obtaining it and securing it, that led to the detection of the drugs. And so we're lining these Fourth Amendment dominoes up, right? The officer is in the car in order to get to the firearm. Once in the car, there's this odor, and they detected the presence of drugs, smelled marijuana. And that this officer's trained on the smell of marijuana, knows what marijuana smells like, knows what the odor is. And so the detection of this marijuana in this vehicle leads to the probable cause that there's marijuana on that side of the vehicle. And she opens that side, the passenger side door, and there are the bags there. And she seizes the bags, and inside the bags, the marijuana, the meth, and the scales, and the distribution tools. And so we line it, and then they're seized under the plain view doctrine as well. So we're lining these dominoes up. And the court noted that the only causation question is whether Mayer would have decided to run a background check and ask the defendant to exit the car, even if he hadn't asked him about the purpose of the travel. And the court said the answer is clearly yes. In other words, he asked him a few questions about what he was doing there and why he was traveling, and what his purpose was in the parking lot. And once he'd asked these questions, he asked him to step out. He would have asked him to step out anyway. And so the answers to the questions did not lead to having him step out, and therefore it fails the but-for test. The court says the necessary but-for causal connection between the travel plan questions and the discovery of the evidence is absent. And so the exclusionary rule would not kick in, even if asking those travel plan questions would have been a Fourth Amendment violation. So there it is, United States versus Cone from the Tenth Circuit, with a nice little refresher on the Rodriguez decision from the United States Supreme Court from a couple years ago, the importance of not having that gap and what's permissible and what's not permissible when it comes to extending a routine traffic stop. Okay, the next case that I've selected for this edition of Broadcast Blue is United States versus Page. And this case comes to us from the Seventh Circuit, and it's dated the 1st of September, 2017. So here are the facts. After midnight on January 2nd, 2016, an employee at a McDonald's restaurant in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, dialed 911. And when she called 911, informed the operator that there was a vehicle that had been sitting in the McDonald's drive-thru lane for approximately an hour. And people were concerned that either the driver was either sick or possibly injured. So this is a 911 call that comes in from the McDonald's drive-thru in Milwaukee. Both fire and police units responded to the call. The fire department shows up first. Milwaukee police officer Tiara Sheets Walker arrives on the scene. When she shows up, she sees a man, later identified as the defendant in this case, Mr. Page, standing outside the open driver's door of the vehicle, talking to Captain Hornick of the Milwaukee Fire Department, who had gotten there just a minute or so before she had arrived, and he showed up with two other firefighters. So three firefighters show up a minute or so later. Police officer Tiara Sheets Walker shows up there at the Milwaukee McDonald's drive-thru a little after midnight. So as Officer Sheets Walker approached Mr. Page and Captain Hornick, she smelled marijuana that detected the strong odor of fresh marijuana coming from Mr. Page. Now, she's been trained. She knows what the marijuana smells like. She detects the strong odor of fresh marijuana coming from Mr. Page. Captain Hornick explained to Officer Sheets Walker that he had found Mr. Page asleep in the driver's seat of the vehicle, and the vehicle was still parked in the drive-through lane of this McDonald's, which is open. It's one of those McDonald's that are open late and open all night. The vehicle was still parked there. He's standing outside of the car. Apparently, the captain had informed her that he had woken Mr. Page by knocking on the car window, and that he had indicated he'd just fallen asleep. So Officer Sheets Walker speaks with Mr. Page, tries to obtain a general information, gets his name and his address, and she walks him toward her police wagon. Officer Sheets Walker testified that Mr. Page appeared to be sleepy. He kept his eyes low, and he walked real slow. She also testified that his version of the events, that he'd just fallen asleep in the drive-thru, seemed a little suspicious to her because he'd been asleep in the drive-thru lane for over an hour. And as they were speaking, Officer Sheets Walker continued to smell the strong odor of fresh marijuana coming from his person. So in addition, so she's walking him over to the car. She also knows that in her mind, marijuana, the drugs and guns go hand in hand. The drugs and guns are typically associated with one another. She indicated at that time that she planned to detain him temporarily before continuing to investigate. But also, they've got this police department policy that an officer should ensure that a person doesn't have drugs or a weapon before placing them in a police vehicle. So what she does, she pats him down. She walks him over to the police car, and she pats him down to make sure that he doesn't have weapons or contraband on him. And during this pat down, she discovers that he's got a firearm in the rear waistband of his pants. He's got a Glock 22 40 cal stuck in the back of his pants there. And she pats him down, and she feels this Glock. And it turns out it's got one bullet in the chamber and 12 in the magazine. And he didn't have a permit to carry a concealed weapon, and so she arrests him. She arrests him for carrying a concealed weapon and placed him in the back of the police vehicle. She then went over to Mr. Page's vehicle, which was still parked in the McDonald's drive-thru. And the windows are shut, and the door is shut, but she can see a bottle of alcohol on the driver's seat, and even without a door or a window open, she can also smell a strong odor of fresh marijuana coming from the vehicle. So she searches the vehicle right there in the McDonald's drive-thru, and she finds a digital scale, clear sandwich bags containing over 10 grams of crack cocaine and over 9 grams of marijuana inside the middle console to the car. So a couple months later, a grand jury returns a 2-count indictment against Mr. Page, charging him with 1 count of possession of a firearm by a felon and 1 count of possession with intent to distribute crack cocaine and marijuana. You know what's going to happen? The defense attorney, that's not fair, got to be a Fourth Amendment violation, files that motion to suppress the fruits of the search, which both the firearm and then eventually the drugs, claiming that the officer had no lawful basis to pat him down because she lacked a reasonable suspicion he was armed and dangerous. The government, in response to that, submitted that the search was lawful because she actually had probable cause to arrest Mr. Page for the marijuana possession and for operating a vehicle under the influence. Therefore, the search of Page's person in the vehicle was permissible as an SIA, as a search incident to arrest. And alternatively, the government argued the search was lawful because the officer had a reasonable suspicion that he was presently armed and dangerous, and which is the whole concept of a Terry frisk. Or the third alternative, because the officer would have inevitably discovered the evidence anyway because of the strong marijuana emanating from the vehicle. So the defense is making one argument that the officer didn't have the reasonable suspicion to conduct the pat down, and the government comes up with three alternative arguments that say, hey, it's under any of these arguments, it's okay. One little thing I want to point out here, it's really kind of interesting, is that the officer says that he was being detained while she was going to conduct a further investigation, and she conducted this pat down frisk of this person because drugs and guns go hand in hand. So the officer is making an argument for this pat-down, Terry frisk. And if you recall from the two very important judicially recognized exceptions, these JREs that we got from Terry versus Ohio, the Terry stop, which is that limited seizure with a reasonable suspicion of the person's involved in criminal activity, and then the Terry frisk, which is that limited type of search that you get with that pat-down frisk that you get with a reasonable suspicion that someone who's been lawfully detained is presently armed and dangerous. And so the officer's kind of making the argument for a Terry frisk in this case because the arrest formally didn't come until after the pat down. Found the gun, and once the gun was found, knew the person did not have the permit to carry the concealed weapon. Of course, at that time, didn't know that the person was a convicted felon. And so there's a whole bunch of facts going on here, but you got these alternative arguments that are being made in all kinds of directions. And that's an important, it's going to be an important part of the court's decision. So I kind of wanted to point that out from the beginning. Now, the magistrate, the trial court denied the motion, and so this is going to go up on appeal. So we have two searches that took place here that both resulted in plain view seizures, which is another judicially recognized exception, a plain view seizure doctrine. The first search that took place was the pat down of Mr. Page's person when he patted him down, and then that resulted in the firearm that was found in the waistband. And as a convicted felon, now he's being charged with being a felon in possession of a firearm. So that's the first search that the defense is arguing was a violation of the Fourth Amendment, the search of his person. So let's talk about the search of his person first before we get to the search of the car. And the court addressed that first as well in their decision. And they stated that, you know, we have to look at the search of Mr. Page. First, we're going to see whether or not it can be justified as a search incident to arrest. So it's interesting that they skipped right over the whole Terry frisk notion and went straight to an SIA, that search incident to arrest type of scenario. And that's what they did. And the court noted that a warrantless arrest is constitutionally permissible if it's supported by probable cause. You can't have a search incident to arrest unless you have a lawful arrest. And probable cause for an arrest exists if the totality, under a totality of the facts and circumstances that's within the officer's knowledge at the time, if they are sufficient to warrant a prudent person or one of reasonable caution to believe in the circumstances shown that the suspect has committed, is committing, or about to commit an offense. And that is a very significant key case Supreme Court decision, Michigan D. Filippo, and that is 443 U.S. 31. That was a case that was decided way back in 1979. So the court then notes that they agree with other circuits. And again, remember, this is the Seventh Circuit, but they pointed out that they agree with, specifically, they agree with the Fourth and the Eighth Circuits when it comes to the fact that if the officer, the odor of marijuana is sufficiently localized to a specific person, then it provides probable cause to arrest that person for the crime of marijuana possession. And this is Wisconsin. This isn't Colorado or California or any of those other states. This is Wisconsin. And so that this detection of this odor that's to a particular person, remember that particularity clause, that particularity section of the warrants clause of the Fourth Amendment kicks in. And if you can get it down to a particular person, to arrest a particular person, the officer has to have probable cause to believe that a particular person is committing or has committed the offense. And so when you've got this marijuana, these additional factors have to be present in order to support this inference that this person possesses or has possessed the contraband. And so there's a concern, the concern for adequate particularity, and this concern is satisfied when the officer smells the odor of marijuana in circumstances where the officer can localize the source to a particular person. And so it's not the fact that, hey, we smell marijuana and there's people here. It's I smell marijuana and this particular person is the source of that odor, and that is the localization that's needed. When the odor is localized, it gets that localized where it's down to one person, then the officer has probable cause to arrest because he has reason to believe that the person has committed or is committing the crime of possession of marijuana. And so that's a really important a part of this case. And the court then noted, if the officer has probable cause to arrest, then she may also conduct a search incident to that lawful arrest without any additional justification. This is its own judicially recognized exception, and the court cites a very key case for that, another Supreme Court decision, United States versus Robinson. And the court noted that the Supreme Court had explained that searching a person incident to arrest enables officers to safeguard evidence, to keep them from destroying or getting rid of the evidence, and most critically, to ensure their own safety during the extended exposure which follows that follows when they take someone into custody and transport them to the police station. Also cite another key Supreme Court case there, Virginia versus Moore, 553 U.S. 164, and that's a 2008 decision. So now you've got the rule of law here, and then the court goes on to say, look, the record before us, clearly it establishes firmly that Officer Sheets Walker had probable cause to arrest Mr. Page for marijuana possession. And she testified that upon first approaching him, she could smell the strong skunky smell coming from off of his person. So she smelled it coming off of him. It's particularized. And she associated the fresh marijuana, the smell, and continued to smell it emanating off his body even as she walked him to her police wagon. So the odor was with him. The odor was particularized to him. There were no other people in the parking lot at the time of their interaction, and there were only three cars in the entire parking lot. So the court says, based on these circumstances, they agree with the district court's conclusion that Officer Sheets Walker had probable cause to arrest Mr. Page for marijuana possession. So once we've got that, you've got the arrest. You have to have a valid arrest before you can have a search incident to arrest. So we've got the valid arrest. The court went on to say that Officer Sheets Walker had probable cause to arrest him for operating a vehicle while under the influence. In addition to arresting him for the smell of the marijuana, she had probable cause to arrest him for operating a vehicle under the influence. Officer Sheets Walker knew that the car had been stopped in the drive-through lane at the McDonald's for nearly an hour, for so long that a McDonald's employee called 911 expressing concern about this person's well-being, whether they're sick or injured. Combined that with Mr. Page's drowsiness and that the fact that he wasn't answering her questions truthfully, Officer Sheets Walker had reason to believe that Mr. Page was impaired, and they conclude that Officer Sheets Walker had probable cause to arrest Page for operating a vehicle under the influence. So the court says because Officer Sheets Walker had the probable cause needed to arrest for both the offense of possession of marijuana and for driving the vehicle under the influence, her subsequent pat-down of Mr. Page was permissible incident to the arrest. So it was a permissible SIA, search incident to arrest. Now, I know what you're thinking here. You're saying, hey, Bruce, wait a minute. She did the pat-down before the arrest, and so how can, if it's a search incident to arrest, how can she do the search before the arrest takes place? And the court notes that the result is unaffected by Officer Sheets Walker's decision to conduct the search before arresting Mr. Page. And they note that the Supreme Court explained in another key case, Rawlings versus Kentucky, where the formal arrest follows quickly on the heels of the challenged search, it's not particularly important that the search preceded the arrest rather than vice versa. And that's another, that's an important a key case, Rawlings versus Kentucky, 448 U.S. 98, back from 1980. And so therefore, they said, look, just because he was told he was under arrest after that search took place does not mean that it doesn't fit the parameters. It cannot be a search incident to arrest. One doesn't have to be technically take place before the other. As where the formal arrest follows quickly on the heels of the challenge search, then it's still okay. And so they said, hey, look, this was his search was a valid search incident to arrest for either one of these two offenses that he could have been arrested for, and therefore the SIA is okay. And the plain view seizure of that Glock is going to be valid, and it's going to go into evidence. Okay, so that's the search of the person. What about the search of the car? Because remember, she went over to the vehicle after he'd been arrested, after the SIA, and she does, and she finds the Glock, and he's been arrested. She goes back to the car, and she searches the car. And the defendant in this case, Mr. Page, contended that the search of the car also violated the Fourth Amendment. He wants that evidence to get thrown out, all the drugs that were found in the car. He wants those to get thrown out. The court noted that they start with the fundamental and very important principle that warrantless searches are per se unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment, subject to only a few well-delineated exceptions. I call these JREs, judicially recognized exceptions. So a quick little side tour here, a little detour, but just an important little refresher. I mean, the Fourth Amendment says that all government searches and seizures must be reasonable. And in order for a search or a seizure to be reasonable, you need either a warrant or one of these judicially recognized exceptions, what I abbreviate as a JRE. And we're talking about exceptions here. Every search and seizure that took place in this entire encounter in this case were warrantless. The seizure of his person, the search of his person, and the search of the vehicle, and the seizure of the firearm and the seizure of the drugs, they're all warrantless searches and seizures. And so they have to be done in order for them to be valid under the Fourth Amendment. In order for them to be reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, they have to be done under a delineated, a very specific, judicially recognized exception, or a JRE. And one of the ones that they first talk about here is the search incident to arrest of a vehicle. Now, we had another important case came out back in 2009, and you might recall because it kind of changed the way a lot of us did business when it came to searching cars, automobiles, incident to arrest, and that was Arizona versus Gantt, 556 U.S. 332 from back in 2009. Very significant and important case, and Justice Scalia, in the opinion that he wrote, creating that little exception there. Basically, in order for you to SIA a vehicle, in order for you to search a vehicle incident to arrest, you have to meet one of two different tests or possibilities or prongs, right? Either they have to, the area in the vehicle that you're searching has to be in their lunging area, which pretty much means you have to leave them in the car, which would be very dangerous and not very wise at all, right? So that's practically speaking, that's never going to happen. Or you have to have a reasonable belief that evidence of the crime for which the person's been arrested will be found in the vehicle. And the lower courts have taken that reasonable belief not to mean probable cause, but it means more akin to a reasonable suspicion. So it's that reasonable suspicion, the evidence for which the person has been arrested will be found in the car. That's what's required in order to have the ability to do that search incident to arrest under a vehicle. And we get that from the Arizona versus Gantt case. There's another JRE, though, that's applicable. There's another judicially recognized exception that allows us to search a vehicle without a warrant and have it nevertheless be reasonable. And that is what is commonly referred to as the Carroll Doctrine from Carroll versus United States way back in 1925, one of those key Supreme Court decisions where the court said, with probable cause that evidence or contraband is located in a vehicle, then you can search the vehicle. And I don't want to get into the whole concept of how the Carroll Doctrine's morphed over the last 80, 90 years. But that's also called the mobile conveyance doctrine. The key concept of that, and as it was reiterated in Maryland versus Dyson, which was a Supreme Court decision in 1999, basically, it's called the automobile exception. It gives you an officer the ability to search a vehicle when the officer has probable cause to believe that the vehicle contains evidence of criminal activity. Now, note, with Gantt, it's a reasonable suspicion, but it's narrow. You have to have a reasonable suspicion, not that any evidence or contraband will be in the car. What you have to have is a reasonable suspicion that evidence of the crime for which the person's been arrested will be found in the car, that reasonable suspicion of that. With Carroll, it's the standard's a little higher. It's probable cause, but this probable cause is of that there's evidence or contraband in the vehicle. It doesn't have to be, it's not related to an arrest. It's not incident. It doesn't have to be incident to arrest. So there's two different JREs at play here that could possibly allow for the search of the vehicle by the officer in this case. And the court pretty much says that they are both applicable. With respect to the search incident to arrest exception, the court noted that although the first prong was inapplicable because he wasn't in the vehicle, the second prong of the exception, the court says clearly applies. Although Officer Sheets Walker already had placed Mr. Page in the back of the police wagon when she searched his vehicle, she certainly had a reasonable basis for believing the vehicle contained evidence of the offenses of the arrest, marijuana possession, and impaired driving. Remember, they said she had PC to arrest him for two separate things and a reasonable belief that evidence of both of those are in the vehicle. And as she approached the car, she could smell the strong odor of marijuana. And therefore, she also has the Carroll Doctrine. Given the strong odor she smelled in the proximity of the vehicle, that she had probable cause to believe the vehicle contained more of that substance. And so either under Gantt or Carroll, she is going to be able to search the car. It's kind of nice that the Seventh Circuit ran through all of these analyses. They didn't take a shortcut. They could have just plucked one of these and said, you know what, based on this, the search is okay without going into the other one and giving us this this decision. But they did, which is really kind of nice to see. Sometimes they take shortcuts, and the Seventh Circuit didn't do that. They looked at all of these things and said, look, the search of his person was okay, and the search of the vehicle was okay, and so the seizure of the firearm from his person was a lawful plain view seizure, in other words, lawful observation, lawful access, immediately recognizable as contraband, and so that plain view seizure, which itself is a JRE, is valid under the Fourth Amendment, and with the car, the going into the car either under Gantt or going into the car under Carroll, the automobile exception. Either way, the search of the car was reasonable under the Fourth Amendment under either of those two exceptions. Take your pick. And therefore, the plain view seizure of the drugs in the car is valid, is lawful under the Fourth Amendment. So there you have it. Another one of these interesting cases, United States versus Page from the Seventh Circuit. And that brings us to our last case for this edition of Broadcast Blue, and that is United States versus Lewis. This case comes to us from the Sixth Circuit, and it is dated the 25th of August, 2017. One summer evening in August of 2014, a police officer, Greg Turner, responded to reports that a woman was intoxicated in a Walmart in London, Kentucky. Once inside the Walmart, he found the woman that he identified later as Carol Lakes. Officer Turner noticed that her balance was off and that she was holding herself up by using the buggy to balance herself, and she had trouble keeping her eyes open and kept nodding off. Once he got closer to her, he further noticed that her speech was very slurred and her eyes were red and glassy and her mouth was really dry. Officer Turner then concluded that she was clearly under the influence, and he approached her and he asked her if she was all right. Lakes told Officer Turner that she had been taking pain pills due to some back trouble. He asked Lakes if she was in the Walmart by herself, and she answered that she was at Walmart with her boyfriend, who was later identified as the defendant in this case, Ronald Lewis. And she told Officer Turner that Lewis was outside in his truck. And so Officer Turner responded to her, well, we'll go see if your boyfriend's all right and talk to him, and he can drive you home out of here. If he can drive you out of here, you can go home. Officer Turner suggested to Lakes that he would have to arrest her if Lewis couldn't drive home because of her public intoxication. At some point, another police officer, Officer Cloyd, arrives on the scene, and Lakes told the officers that her boyfriend would in fact be able to drive her home, and she led both of them outside to the boyfriend's truck so they could check to make sure that he was all right to drive. So both of these officers approach the defendant Lewis's four-door Chevy truck. It's very dark outside and the truck's windows are tinted, and they couldn't even tell whether anyone was in the vehicle. Officer Turner goes over to the front driver's side of the truck, looked through the window, and saw Lewis asleep on the passenger side. So he's on the driver's side, looks through the window, and sees Lewis asleep on the passenger side. Officer Cloyd and Lakes went around to the passenger side of the truck, and Officer Cloyd opened the door. And when the door was open, the interior dome light popped on, and this startled Lewis, who did a little jerk. The light enabled Officer Turner to see that Lewis, the dome light, enabled Officer Turner to see that Lewis had a clear plastic baggie on his lap. And as soon as the light pops on, he's kind of startled. The doors opened up. He tosses the baggie over the truck's console and onto the back floorboard. So it's the front and rear, the king cab of the truck. There's a rear, there's a back seat and a back floorboard. And he just tosses that baggie over the console between the two front seats into the back floorboard. Officer Turner suspected that the baggie contained marijuana. He shined his flashlight onto the baggie on the back of the floorboard and observed that it contained a bluish-colored substance in it, which he thought could be either marijuana or pills. And Officer Turner opens the truck door and inspects the bag more closely and sees that it does, in fact, contain a bunch of pills. Turner asked Lewis about the pills. Lewis stated he didn't know nothing about them, and that's all he would say. He also appeared to be under the influence as well, based on his slurred speech. So Lewis and Lake were both arrested. The bag of pills were tested and found to contain 493 oxycodone tablets, 5 Xanax, and additional 4 Xanax were found in Lewis's pockets on his person. So a lot of pills, a lot of narcotics are found there. And it goes without saying that there was no prescription for that. So Lewis is indicted on various charges related to the possession of the oxys and the Xanax in violation of federal law. Lewis moved to suppress all the evidence seized in the car as products of an illegal search. Boy, you knew that was coming, didn't you? Hey, that's not fair. Got to be an illegal search. And, you know, I don't want to besmirch the defense community. That's typically it's what they have to hang their hat on, right? I mean, if the best they can do for their client is to get the evidence thrown out, because otherwise they're looking at some serious time and some serious charges. You can't blame them for making the argument and holding us accountable to the Fourth Amendment, and that's what they do. Hey, got to be a Fourth Amendment issue here, right? Now I tell you, and I can't think of a single case as a federal prosecutor that I ever had, a felony case anyway, a serious case, that was litigated, that didn't happen. I mean, it's almost a given that they're going to file a motion to suppress the evidence. They're going to make an argument that there was a Fourth Amendment violation and the exclusionary rule should kick in. Or they're going to make an argument that there was a Fifth Amendment self-incrimination violation, that Miranda warnings weren't properly given, and that confessions should be thrown out. It's usually the only card they've got to play, and one of the bigger cards they have to play. So can't really fault them for that, and that's exactly what happened. Lewis moved to suppress all the evidence seized in the vehicle as products of an illegal search. The district court denied Lewis's motions to suppress the evidence, so he pled guilty to 2 of the 4 counts, preserved the right to appeal the denial of his suppression motions, and then he exercised that right on appeal here. The Sixth Circuit agreed with the district court that denied the motions and noted that the police here engaged in a function that was entirely divorced from a criminal investigation, such that the community caretaker exception to the Fourth Amendment applied. This is one of these judicially recognized exceptions. Things that would otherwise constitute a search under the Fourth Amendment are reasonable without a warrant based on one of these different judicially recognized exceptions, or JREs. And one of these JREs is called the community caretaker exception. And the whole concept is that the standard of probable cause is peculiarly related to criminal investigations, but not routine non-criminal procedures. And Officers Turner and Officer Cloyd, their actions fit within this concept of the community caretaker exception. Now, the two key cases that you need to know for this community caretaker function or community caretaker exception are South Dakota versus Opperman, Supreme Court decision found at 428 U.S. 364 back from 1976, as well as Cady versus Dombrowski, 413 U.S. 433, 1973. You might remember in the Dombrowski case where the car, they went into the car looking for the gun because this vehicle belonged to a police officer, and they knew that these police officers routinely carried firearms, and they didn't want the firearm falling into the hands of other people. And once they were inside the vehicle, they found the evidence of this murder that had taken place. And so that's the whole concept. They weren't doing a criminal investigation. They were trying to protect the community. And that's what the community caretaker function or doctrine is all about. And it's particularly applicable to and uniquely applicable to going into automobiles, looking in automobiles and this community caretaker role in a non-criminal investigation. And that's what happened in this case. When they went to the car, it was a community caretaker function. They weren't involved in a criminal investigation when they went to the truck. They were going to find out whether or not she had a ride home and that whether or not he was good to drive too, that she had a way to get home through him driving his own vehicle. And that was the whole purpose. And the court noted that. They look at this three-tiered test for the applicability of the community caretaker function. And they noted, first, these officers' actions fit within the community caretaker exception because they responded to a report that a woman was intoxicated in the Walmart. They're concerned about her. They got someone in the Walmart and they're concerned about her, right? And the purpose of them going to the vehicle wasn't to investigate why it was that she was intoxicated or further investigate any possible criminal activity, although they did indicate they could have arrested her if she didn't have a ride home. The whole purpose was to try and find her a ride home, find her a safe ride home, and that was the purpose, and therefore that fits within the community caretaker exception. The next step there is to look to see if there was any evidence that the officer's actions were taken with this any traditional law enforcement purpose such that the community caretaker exception would have been inapplicable. Now, you can't play one card when both of them are there. If you're involved in a criminal investigation and you can also say that you're doing it for in a community caretaker role, you don't get to play both of those cards. In other words, if there is a criminal investigative purpose, it cannot be masked and fall within this judicially recognized exception under the community caretaker exception. And again, quoting Katie versus Dombrowski, and that's not what happened here. The court said, hey, there's no evidence that there was any traditional law enforcement purpose that was going on that would have rendered this community caretaker exception inapplicable in this particular case. And then third, given the community caretaking nature of the officer's action, the degree any limited intrusion on Lewis's privacy from simply opening the door was reasonable. It was very limited. Their actions were very, very limited. Lewis was in his car and not his home, and that weighs in the favor of the reasonableness of the search. Remember what the Supreme Court said in Florida versus Jardines about the home being the chief among equals of the places of protection of the Fourth Amendment. Well, the community caretaker doctrine doesn't apply to homes, but it does apply to cars. And the fact that he was in his car and not his home makes this more reasonable. And as Supreme Court noted, the case that gave rise to the community caretaker exception, quote, for the purposes of the Fourth Amendment, there is a constitutional difference between houses and cars because of the ambulatory character of cars and the fact that extensive and often non-criminal contact with automobiles will bring local officials in plain view of evidence, fruits, or instrumentalities of crime or contraband. And again, that citing of Dombrowski, that the Supreme Court decision. So there you've got this whole concept. It was in the vehicle. It was very, very limited. They didn't open the glove box. They didn't go into the center console. They opened the door in an attempt to have a conversation with this person to see if he could drive the other person home, the impaired woman from inside the Walmart. And so given the limited nature of it and the fact that it was an automobile, tends to go towards that reasonableness of the actions. And the court said, furthermore, the officer's intrusion into the car was minimal. They opened the door, and that rules in favor of the reasonableness of that. Okay, so once they're in the car, once the door is opened, and they're in the car, and they're lawfully present in the vehicle under one exception, which is the community caretaker doctrine, the plain view seizure is going to be valid, which is another judicially recognized exception for that warrantless seizure of the oxycodone. and that is the lawful access, lawful observation, immediately recognizable as contraband. In this particular case, it was one JRE that got you the lawful access and observation for the other JRE, lining up those Fourth Amendment dominoes. The officers merely opened the door to check on the apparently sleeping Lewis, which prompted Lewis to throw the baggie containing the pills onto the back floorboard of his truck, catching Officer Turner's attention. The court noted that the officers apparently did not knock on the truck window or attempt to speak with him before opening the door, which might have been more respectful of his privacy. But the court noted that the community caretaking exception is not limited to the least intrusive means of protecting the public. And given that the officer's opening of the door was minimally intrusive, any failure to knock or attempt to speak does not make the officer's actions here unreasonable. So there you go. And that's the decision in this case. And you might be wondering to yourself, self, what about the whole part of the decision dealing with the plain view seizure? Well, that wasn't on appeal. Lewis didn't challenge the lower court's reasoning with respect to the actions of the police after they opened the door and they saw Lewis toss the baggie. And so they didn't review it. There's no decision based on that because it wasn't part of the appeal. So he banked all of his... He put all of his marbles in one sock, and that being the opening of the door. And the opening of the door was lawful, was reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, under the community caretaker doctrine. Well, that's it for this inaugural edition of Broadcast Blue, 1 hour. Time flies when you're having fun. Hope you've enjoyed it. Hope you've learned a little something going through these three cases. I want to invite you to join me also. On every Wednesday, we are going to have an actual video that comes out. We're going to take one case and really dissect it with a video so you can see different things on the screen and not just listen to it as we do with this podcast. Thank you so much for joining us for this our first podcast. We're going to do it every Sunday night. Please subscribe if you haven't already. You can do it with both Apple, with iTunes, and on Google Play. Broadcast Blue, just search on Broadcast Blue, or you can sign up using your favorite RSS feed at www.broadcast.blue. Thank you so much for what you do, and we hope to see you again real soon. This is Bruce Allen Barnard signing off for now.